think a little bit of what we're seeing is a wait and see approach to determine the flood of additional executive orders to figure out whether there's other direction and guidance coming from the president that might dictate how this needs to go forward and how the commission would follow that path.
Hello and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, the only platform to bring financial reporting, sustainability, audit, and risk teams together so you can deliver assured integrated reporting. That's when you bring financial and non-financial data together so it's ready to be audited. And if there's one thing you want when there's an audit, it's to be ready. Am I right? My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. Looking forward to debuting a great conversation, and I'm happy, as always, to be joined by Catherine Tsai. Catherine, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a professional asker of questions, and I like to drink venti soy chais, and I'm looking forward to today's conversation.
Yeah, me too. So we're going to talk today about the SEC climate rule. There's been some recent updates. For a refresher, that rule was adopted in March of 2024, but stalled right out of the gate.
Yep, there was almost immediate litigation, and then the SEC ended up staying the rule. And then in February, acting SEC Chair Mark Ueda indicated the SEC would be asking courts not to schedule arguments in the case.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as with all other things SEC, we decided to phone a friend and returning guest for the podcast. We've got Alan Wilson here, partner at WilmerHale. Alan, thank you again for joining us.
Hey there, it's good to be with you again. I'm delighted to be on Off the Books for I don't know which time this is, but certainly glad to be back as always.
Well, we're glad to have you back. So as Catherine mentioned, Acting Chair Ueda's statement really only asked the court for more time or to delay arguments. And as I read it, basically so the SEC could kind of figure out or have their own additional time to figure out what to do next in light of the administration change. Alan, what does this actually mean from a legal perspective? I mean, these rules can't just disappear at the whim of a chair acting or otherwise.
That's right. So as Catherine summarized, the rule was stayed very quickly after it was adopted. And then it's been the subject of legal challenge in the Eighth Circuit for since its adoption. And currently what happened is as a result of the statement is effectively the commission is taking some additional time to review internally its position in terms of defending the rule. So as you know, as part of the Eighth Circuit challenge, the commission is on the defense side actually defending the adoption of the rules. As Chair Ueda's statement notes, he and Commissioner Peirce actually voted against the adoption of the rules in the first instance and are taking heed of the memorandum regarding a regulatory freeze from the president to consider whether the commission should continue spending resources to defend the rule. As part of the statement, Commissioner Ueda noted that there was a lack of statutory authority is one of the weighty factors that the commission needs to take into account. And so what really is happening behind the scenes is the commission is taking a look at the actual arguments to be made and considering the merits of those and whether it wants to continue defending the rule itself. So what could happen is you could imagine the commission deciding that it no longer wants to continue to defend the rule and to basically settle and close the litigation, which would effectively result in the rule not going into effect or keeping the permanent stay in place. So the alternative would be that the commission repivots and effectively puts forth a different type of defense or further modifies the defense or just simply decides to allow the current defense to go forward on the current timing after further consideration, in which case the Eighth Circuit proceeding would continue to play out. I think a little bit of what we're seeing is a wait and see approach to determine the flood of additional executive orders to figure out whether there's other direction and guidance coming from the president that might dictate how this needs to go forward and how the commission would follow that path. You could also imagine a scenario where the commissioners are waiting for the full commission to be built out over time for additional commissioners to be appointed to have a full commission review the status of the case and then determine, you know, A, whether that affects the litigation strategy or frankly, the decision to have the rules go into effect at all or simply to basically make that a permanent stay such that the rules are effectively never adopted and just rescinded. So I think there are any number of avenues, but certainly what we're seeing right now is just a wait and see and a further consideration, at least in light of the current executive order, to figure out whether or not that needs to bear on the current litigation and the timing that is, of course, more pressing there than maybe that might play out as it relates to the commission staffing and appointment process.
Yeah, on the timing, do you have any guess of how soon we might have an answer?
I really don't. I tend to think it's not a matter of weeks. It's probably longer than that to see it play out. But I say that, and the number of executive orders and other things coming out of Washington these days are happening at a lightning speed. So you could imagine it might be faster than in a normal world. But generally, I think the pressure is off at the moment. And so you can imagine a scenario where it continues to take a period of months, in fact, before you actually see a more permanent resolution or guidance as it relates to next steps in the litigation proceeding.
Alan, this whole thing feels, I don't know, kind of like weighty to me as far as like this sort of immediate, you know, pendulum swinging from one to the other. And of course, we tend to see a little bit of that with every administration change. But is there any recent precedent or anything we could maybe go back in history? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but does anything come to mind where we could sort of point back to as giving some kind of indication as to how this plays out?
It really isn't. This is sort of unprecedented in terms of the way in which we're seeing such a pendulum shift. I think it's not terribly surprising given the way we saw the pendulum swept in the last administration in terms of much more extensive rule adoption, including in the face of significantly strong opposition through the comment letter process. But we haven't yet seen the unwinding, at least to this degree. As you noted, obviously, with every change in administration, there's a little bit of undoing and moving forward, you know, with different regulatory priorities. But generally speaking, where you have bodies that are not supposed to be politicized, it's kind of interesting to see that the rulemaking at least shifts as significantly, potentially, depending upon how this turns out. So I think it's one where we should probably wait and see how it actually develops before we make conclusions. But it would be one of the larger changes probably in history as it relates to the way you've seen the pendulum swing all the way to a fulsome set of rules to maybe a potential rescinding of the rules that have been proposed and adopted.
One thing that I was looking for in his statement and looking for generally as this whole thing played out with the March 2024 climate disclosure rule is any indication about what happens to the 2010 climate guidance, where summarizing here, you need to disclose the material impacts due to climate change. And so I was a little bit surprised that in Acting Chair Ueda's statement, he actually referenced Commissioner Peirce saying that that 2010 climate guidance appeared sufficient. I believe those were the words that she used. Do you think then that that's maybe a potential long-term indication that particular guidance will remain in effect?
I think it is. I think you can read that appropriately to say that it would remain in effect. And I would say with that guidance and other guidance from that era, it really was more of a first principles perspective, which is to say it was far less prescriptive in terms of the requirements. And what it does is distill the existing securities disclosure rules with the current materiality framework. And it puts that into context of climate, but it could be applied in any other context as well. And it gives companies a general sense of the way in which they would handle their disclosures from just those first principles, as opposed to the more prescriptive approach you saw in the actual climate rules that we're talking about now. And so I think going forward, as you think about it, it may be, in fact, the way companies should think about their disclosure obligations more broadly, because I think that guidance would stay. And it's one where you evaluate your company's posture and you look through the existing rules and you apply the general reasonable investor test and you make your judgment calls there, as opposed to having the more prescriptive footnote and other line item disclosure requirements that we saw in the Gensler era rules.
Well, let's say the SEC decides to pause the rule indefinitely or otherwise get rid of it. Is there any world where there would be maybe environmental groups or something that sue to try to make the SEC go forward with the rule as it had proposed?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they certainly could, and they could challenge, I suppose, the way in which, you know, any type of rule termination took place. I don't know how that would work, depending upon the nature or the basis for which the rule might be rescinded. I think you could imagine that would be the area of challenge and whether it followed appropriate APA requirements, if there's some modified version of the rule, particularly, that goes into place instead. I think it really is an unknown, but I tend to think the likelihood of success is probably pretty low, absent a specific congressional authority to take action, you know, where the SEC has failed to do so, at least in terms of adopting these specific rules.
Use your accounting experience as intended. Gain the speed and flexibility you need to understand the why behind your financials and keep your execs informed, all without working another late night. Discover how at Workiva.com/accounting. That's Workiva.com/accounting. Workiva, where your most important financial reporting work comes together.
Well, as we look at how this is all playing out, I mean, I'm curious, Alan, you're having conversations with certainly out in the market with the companies that you serve. I'm wondering, what are you advising? What are you telling people to do just to stay ready and prepared for, again, as you mentioned earlier, just a very fast changing landscape? And it seems like companies almost need to be ready for anything at this point.
Yeah, so I would say I'm encouraging companies to make sure they're taking a look at their peers to understand collectively what those within their same industry group are seeing, at least as there relates to disclosure and input from their investors. As you noted, a lot is changing in the landscape, and it's one where there is some degree of uncertainty. I would say at a holistic aggregate level, we're seeing companies generally pull back on their disclosures, certainly that are voluntary, around the ESG and the DE&I space, particularly in light of some executive orders and other shifts in the political landscape. But it is also the case that they're considering, in fact, the future disclosures and really the needs of all stakeholders. So it's a balancing act that they're undertaking at the moment from a risk perspective and balancing needs and demands of stakeholders with government and other regulator expectations on the other hand, and then balancing it to result in disclosure, which continues to evolve. So the key takeaway is to be flexible and adaptable to change going forward and continuing to monitor and pivot at a rapid pace as needed to make sure that they're managing the risk exposure appropriately, disclosure to disclosure. And it's certainly one that I think will continue in a more dynamic pace over the coming reporting cycles as we continue to see more from the Trump administration and we see more companies and stakeholders adapt and stake out new positions in light of changing priorities on a macro level.
We should mention the 2025 Executive Benchmark on Integrated Reporting, which is a new report that Workiva put out. It shows there are a number of companies that are still moving forward with some of these disclosures just because other stakeholders are asking for that information. Like they want to know, what are your emissions and what are you doing to mitigate them, and what are the risks and the opportunities?
Yeah, it's interesting to see just that balance and to think about those conversations that must be going on behind the scenes. I mean, again, that research, or at least in that report, it was very conclusive that at least, a vast majority of the companies that were surveyed said that they are moving forward. But again, you also have, to your point earlier, Alan, people kind of reading the tea leaves, seeing what's happening with the administration and having to think really carefully about, okay, what are we going to say publicly? What will maybe continue, but we're just not going to be as public about it. I mean, clearly, again, just based on that survey, people are seeing value in it. Organizations are seeing the value in it. But it's interesting to see how they sort of like navigate some of the political complexity that goes along with it. So as we get ready to wrap up here, Alan, as you know, we always like to end with a somewhat lighthearted closing question. Catherine, you want to lob that out for us?
Sure. Okay, Alan, aside from SEC rules, is there any other rule or proposed rule in life that you'd like to revisit?
I'd like to review and revisit some of the tax rules on standard deduction itemization.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's so funny. So when people think about, okay, like what do you do in this environment? You know, how do you stay ready, prepared, or whatever? I hear that so many times actually is like, hey, I'd like to revisit the itemized versus the standard deduction for tax purposes. Catherine, I'll tell you the rule that I would like to revisit. So when my wife and I go out on a date, we always alternate who picks the place where we go eat, which is kind of a fun thing, I suppose. But she bamboozles me into thinking that like it's actually my turn when in fact it is not. So I would like to go back and just revisit that whole rule at the beginning, and maybe we don't alternate, right? Maybe it's her every time. I have no idea. But that's a longstanding Soder family precedent that I would love to go back and reconsider. I'd like that rule to be stayed.
Is it hard to choose? Is that why?
Well, yeah, it's impossible to choose, which then tells me like, well, then why don't we just save some money and stay home? Like if none of us are that excited about anything, maybe that's an indication that we can just cook from home, which is probably a better meal and better for us anyway. How about you, Catherine? What rule do you want to reconsider?
The only one I can think of is maybe Oxford comma. I know it's controversial, Oxford comma versus not Oxford comma. When do you use it? When do you not? That's all I got.
Well, hang on a second. Alan, can you weigh in on this? You're an attorney. You write a ton, and as I have seen, are quite good. What's your take on the Oxford comma?
Oh, I'm pro-Oxford comma. Should be used in all instances. I am not a fan of the absence of the Oxford comma.
Interesting. See, I felt the same way, and I had a CFO railroad me. I mean, yell at me. And like this guy had a temper. He had a yelling problem. He was not using his inside voice very often. But he railroaded me for my persistent use of an Oxford comma. And I was shocked that somebody would get so worked up about it. Anyway, well, not a fan of the Oxford comma. What's that?
It's absolutely essential to use. It changes meaning.
It does.
It does. And that's what I explained to him. That was exactly what I explained to him. Nope. Nope. I don't want to see that comma anymore. I don't ever want to see an Oxford comma ever again. Yeesh. All right. Well, with that.
Yes, with that. Thank you, Alan, for joining us yet again.
Glad to be back.
And thank you, dear listener, for surfing along with us. I'm Catherine Tsai. You heard Steve Soder. And this has been Off the Books presented by Workiva.
Yes, well, this is actually going to be one of the last episodes that you will hear of Off the Books presented by Workiva because we are cooking up something brand new. So please stay tuned for that. In the meantime, surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.